This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Writers often say that when they publish a novel, their greatest hope is that it will touch their readers' hearts and minds. But when Joanna Catherine Scott heard from John Lee Conaway about her book, The Road from Chapel Hill, she was taken aback. John was an inmate on death row in Raleigh Central Prison. He'd been convicted of killing two men back in 1991. Not only did he find the novel moving, but he wanted to meet her. Joanna knew nothing about America's prisons. She certainly didn't know anyone inside prison, but her instincts as a mother and a former teacher got the better of her. So she went to see him. Then she went back a second time and a third, and she kept going nearly every week for 5 years. Today, she and John are family. Quite literally, she's adopted him as her seventh child, and they've collaborated on her newest book, a collection of poems called An Innocent in the House of the Dead. Joanna Catherine Scott is here today. Joanna, welcome back to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you very much, Frank. And hello to you guys in Central Prison who are listening. You're in this too.
You wrote this novel called The Road to Chapel Hill. Very well received. We talked about it in this program.
Yes,
got a
did.
Nice review in the NNO, and that's apparently what John read.
Oh, he read an excerpt. The NNO ran an excerpt, and he read the excerpt.
And what happened next?
Well, he was touched by that because he felt that in some way that little excerpt was similar to his life. It was about a runaway slave being hunted through the woods. And he wanted to meet me. And initially he just wanted to read the rest of the book. But his family had abandoned him, as so many families do when their loved ones go to death row. So he asked one of the other guys, Jason, thank you very much for this. He asked Jason to get in touch with his mother and find out what my address was. So his mother very kindly did that, and John wrote to me, just asking for the book initially. So I sent him a copy, and the prison sent it back. You can't send a book in there that your hand has actually touched. So I had my publisher send him a copy. And then shortly after that, he wrote to me again and said that he was very interested in Black history, and it seemed that I was too, and would I come and talk to him? So I said to my husband, what am I going to do? Am I going to go and talk to this person? He said, Joanna, you fainted everything. You go in there, some guy looks cross-eyed at you, you're going to fall on the floor, and I'm going to have to come and haul you out of there. So I talked to my two young Korean daughters, and I was quite shocked at their response. They have totally changed their minds since then. But at the time, their attitude was, let him rot. He's in prison, therefore he must be a bad man. Which I found, you know, in talking to my friends, was a very similar reaction. However, with all this enthusiastic support, I decided that I've always had the feeling, Frank, that if you put a book out into the world and it touches somebody's heart, that you have a moral obligation towards that person to, at the very minimum, be nice to them. And I just felt that this book was leading me somewhere. And so I went to the prison. I was expecting something like Silence of the Lambs, with all sorts of evil men doing evil things and shouting and banging cups on bars and all that sort of thing. But Central Prison is cleverly disguised as something that looks more like a hospital. It's very sanitized, the area that the visitors go into. It's very quiet. You know, lots of black mothers, black wives. It's a predominantly black population in there. So I went to visit John, and I walked into the cell, into the visiting booth. It's like two telephone booths back to back with a wall in between and a reinforced window that you communicate through. And so there's this boy sitting there, and the first thing he said to me was, "I'm nervous," and I said, "I'm nervous too." So we talked and we just clicked mentally. He's a very, very intelligent, very articulate young man, very gentle, very sweet, very thoughtful. And at the end of the visit, which I thought was a one-off, I had no intention of ever becoming a prison visitor, I said to him, "Is there anything I can do for you?" And he said, "Would you come back and visit me?" Just at that moment, one of his mitigation people popped his head into the booth and said hi to John. So as I left, I grabbed this guy and said, I want to come and have a cup of coffee with you and talk about John.
A mitigation person is?
A mitigation person is somebody who works on a case to show causes that were like a bad childhood, like abuse, things that might have affected this person to behave in a certain way that were not his fault, that sort of thing, okay? So he put me onto John's lawyer, who at that time was in Southern Pines, and I went down to visit his lawyer. He took me out to lunch, and I said, everybody is telling me that these guys in prison are con men, that all they want to do is to manipulate me and dominate me, and I don't know what to do. Is this guy a bad guy? And he just laughed. He said, no, John's a good guy, and he's always protested his innocence. So he told me all about the case. It went totally over my head. But since then, in the 5 years since then, I have studied and studied and studied, and I do understand a little bit about the criminal law now.
And a great deal about writing. Your collection of poems that you've written along with John Lee Conaway, roughly the story of his life, An Innocent in the House of the Dead. Can I get you to read one now? Would you read Death Row for us?
Yes, Death Row is essentially John's story in a nutshell. So that's a good one to start with. Death Row. He was an accidental package, thrown away to float upon the surface of the world. An obstacle, a mouth to feed, the nuisance bastard of a rough man's wife. A punching bag, a dog to kick, a pale-skinned black boy, good for nothing but to shove aside, to mock, to stare at with that hard and silent, slow neck turning, straight on stare that sees so little and yet says so much. An ordinary story, his. The giddy highs of gasoline, the bull malt liquor and wild Irish rose, the swift onrush from foster home to foster home, group home to group, as though he travelled down a glass-slick tunnel with the four harsh winds of fate exploding at his back, his panicked hands flung out to seize whatever shone along the way, a box of doughnuts and an apple pie, a winter coat, a pair of shoes with solid soles, a pack of socks, a watch, some bikes. Until a handgun loaned out of his grandma's purse to a cat who called him cousin, friend, slammed him spread-eagled like a cartoon character against the tunnel's silver-badged, blue-uniformed, dead end. And then the slave-like hobbles, lost child mug shots, and the prison label, black, ignoring half his ancestry. The stunned astonishment at what he had become. And after that, beneath the high, shrill, ever-burning light, the long, slow dirge of days and years toward the needle's fatal, sympathetic slide into his arm.
Joanna Catherine Scott reading from An Innocent in the House of the Dead, a story of John Lee Conaway, a man that she has since adopted, who had been on death row, is now in Central Prison. We'll continue our story on the state of things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today we're talking with Chapel Hill writer Joanna Catherine Scott. She's the author of many novels, works of nonfiction, and collections of poetry. Her latest book is a volume of poems called An Innocent in the House of the Dead. It tells the story of John Lee Conaway, who is now in safekeeping in Central Prison in Raleigh. When Joanna met him years ago, he was on death row for murder. Joanna, tell us how John came to be in Central Prison.
All right. He's actually in the population in Central Prison at the moment. John is the result of a rape, actually. His mother was raped by a white businessman in Richmond County when she was 13 years old. Now, it was not jump out of the bushes type rape. It was statutory rape. This child was pimped to this man, and she became pregnant right at the time of the Black is Beautiful movement. So this little girl gives birth to a what looks like a white child. So he started off with the Black community against him because of that. His mother was sent up to DC by her mother with the child, and she was given away to a man up there who bred 5 more children off her, beat her mercilessly, and eventually she left him, took her 6 children up to Cambridge, Maryland. She was a hopeless mother. She will be the first person to admit that to you. And John was brought up in an environment of extreme violence and neglect and eventually abandonment. He has been looking for love ever since, he's told me. He's always wanted to find somebody who would love him like his grandmother. When he was 14, he got involved in some burglaries, part of them with his uncle Johnny, who was a professional crook up there, a great street fighter. Uncle Johnny used to use this skinny kid to crawl in through skylights and side windows in order to open the doors. John was walking one day with a friend of his, and they were looking at the welfare mothers out in their yards and on their porches, and they decided they were going to do something for them. So, stupid kids as they were, they broke into 5 stores and they stole things like bikes for the kids, televisions, food, that sort of thing, and left them secretly on the stoops of these women. However, there was a police plant on the street and he turned them in. They were arrested, and John was given 39 years in adult prison at the age of 2 days over 14.
This is in Maryland.
This is in Maryland. He got out after 10, and I won't go into the entire story, but eventually he broke parole and came down to North Carolina with his cousin because his grandmother, whom he adored down here, was very ill and, you know, on the brink of death. So that's how he got to North Carolina. In North Carolina, he fell in with a cousin of his, and because he was family, he trusted him. But the cousin had friends. You know, people do have friends. One night, his cousin told John that he was nervous walking back to go home through a dangerous neighborhood. And John suggested that he lend him his gun. Now, this sounds terrible to us, but on the street, guns pass backwards and forwards all the time. He gave his cousin his gun because he loved him as a cousin. So love got him into trouble this time, because by lending that gun, he opened himself wide open to being framed. Passing the gun had a domino effect. What happened was 2 store clerks were abducted that night in their own car and murdered in the woods. The responsibility for that was passed on to John. He was fingered, as they say in the trade, and framed by these 3 men, and he took the fall. So that's how he ended up on death row. The aggravating thing there was that John is Black, or at least he's labeled Black, and these 2 store clerks were white. If you are Black and you are accused of murdering white, you're in deep, deep trouble. So that's how John ended up on death row, and he's been fighting to prove his innocence ever since.
He's no longer on death row.
He's not.
How did that status change? Why?
He was granted a writ of habeas corpus by the federal court on grounds of a biased jury. The double first cousin of one of his accusers, the cousin, was on the jury, and he was very vocal about this boy having to fry. This was introduced in his first trial, but I've come to understand that trials have certain blocks in which you can do certain things, and it was introduced at a point in the trial where it was not accepted by the judge. So after a year of waiting for his trial and 14 years on death row, his conviction was overturned and he was granted the right to new trial. Now, because of the way our justice system is, it turns out that he is still in prison, although he's off death row. So we are still working with him on that.
But why are you convinced that he's innocent? You know, it's not a wise thing to lend your gun to somebody if you don't know what they're doing and you might suspect they might be up to no good.
He didn't suspect they were up to no good. There'd been some alcohol drunk that night, so probably his good sense was impaired. He says that, you know, he has said if I hadn't been drinking beer, I probably would never have lent it to him. But, you know, this man was his friend. He was his family. And you take care of your family. You know, when you are, you know, street guys, they take care of each other. And if this guy was afraid of being molested on his way home, then, hey, what do? You pass the gun, and then the gun gets passed back. And it's all part of a day's work or a night's work.
John has insisted on his innocence. He says he was not there that night, didn't pull the trigger, wasn't even there when other friends and cousins stole the car and killed the two shop owners. He does, however, feel some responsibility for what happened.
Yes, he does certainly feel some responsibility. You can be a good person and yet have no wisdom. And what John has said to me often is, I've always been a good person, but I didn't have wisdom. And when he was on death row, he sought after that wisdom. He read and he read and he talked and he argued with other people. And there's good people on, you know, in prison. And, you know, an older man there who was executed gave him a lot of very good advice and counsel. And so he has developed wisdom. And so looking back on what happened, he is able to see that by lending that gun, he started a domino effect that ended in the killing of two men. Even though he didn't do it, he does feel a certain responsibility. So this poem is called On Culpability. And there's a little quote from Ralph Waldo Emerson. Life is a perpetual instruction in cause and effect. I sit and think, you say, about responsibility. Two men are dead because I loaned my grandma's gun. Back then, 16 slow, hard years ago, I had no sense. Keeping it real was all I knew of action or of consequence. So what guilt do I bear? What culpability? None, I'm told, without intention in my hand, that loaded gun. And yet I brought down hell on those two men and on that ignorant boy, myself. Grief is my cellmate every day, my chattering succubus by night. If not for me, two men might now be laughing with their wives. That ghetto boy just might have made himself a decent life. What's done, they say, can't be undone. But should I get the chance to live again, I'll live for those two dead, and for that boy, and for the wiser man I have become.
Joanna Catherine Scott reading from An Innocent in the House of the Dead, that poem called On Culpability. How has your relationship with John, how has your relationship evolved in those, how long do you have to visit? Is it an hour?
It's an hour and a half.
You got 90 minutes a week over 5 years.
Mm-hmm. Now that he's in the population, I have telephone time too.
How has it evolved?
Well, at first it was very formal. We talked about history and we talked about social issues and we talked about politics. He's a great arguer. He has an amazing ability to orate. I call him my street corner preacher. I was very nervous of going to the prison. I wasn't afraid of John, but the prison made me very frightened. The prison itself, I mean, the atmosphere there is so onerous, so miserable, so defeated. And I used to have nosebleeds driving across from Chapel Hill to Raleigh every week for almost a year, stress nosebleeds. John is a kind person, and once I got there, I would relax. So that encouraged me to keep going. And what attracted me to him at the very beginning was his mind. Such a good mind, such an interesting mind, and the ability to read and think and absorb and then talk about things in a very intelligent manner, in a way that, you know, people on the outside that I know are not able to do. And so, you know, over time, we came to talk about more private things. He didn't trust me at first. He didn't trust me in two ways. He didn't trust me not to come back. I mean, he didn't trust me to come back, mm-hmm. you know, because he's had a lot of people coming through his life promising friendship and then they just evaporate. And, you know, it makes him feel as though he's like an animal in a cage just being stared at, and when the curiosity's satisfied, off they go. So it took a while for him to come to understand that he could trust me to come back. And also it took him a while to let his guard down with me, to actually talk to me about himself and his life and his private thoughts and his fears and hopes and all that sort of thing.
What led you to decide to adopt him?
Well, I came to love him first. I mean, as time went by, I came to love him. It's hard not to love somebody who so desperately wants to be loved and wants somebody to love. But last year, Frank, I had cancer. I had surgery. I had anal cancer, which is very undignified. I had surgery. I had the whole chemo radiation thing, and I was really, really sick. And one day I was lying on my bed with my toes in the air waiting for the, you know, the great Reaper to come and take me. And I said to myself, what's the point of writing books that, you know, you die, they get remaindered, somebody pays a dollar for them. You've got to leave behind you something that is absolutely an improvement in the world, something that's really worth leaving behind. And so my husband came into the room with my chicken soup, and I said, I want to adopt John. And he said, but we've already got six children. I said, well, you decided to get the last three, and I'm only wanting one, so I get my pick now this time. So I instituted proceedings as soon as I was better to adopt him. It was a little, you know, complicated adopting an adult and adopting somebody in prison, but the clerk of court was very kind and very helpful, and on the 13th of September this year, he became my legal son. His name is now John Lee Scott, actually.
Mm. Well, and just to explain that previous remark, you had adopted three other children from Korea that together.
Together, the two of you, right, three of them. Yes, yes.
So those are the three that were more like decisions. Will you read, so talking about this relationship evolving into love, one that prompted you to adopt as a son this man who you had come to know. Will you read the poem Stranger for us?
Yes, it's called Stranger, and there's a quote from the famous Irish poet Seamus Heaney at the top. For what is the great moving power and spring of verse, feeling, and in particular, love? I have dreamed strange things, and many stranger, yet never dreamed of loving you, a stranger from a world to which my world is stranger than a dream, yours to mine, a dream of danger. I never dreamed of strangely loving you. What could be stranger than for stranger to love stranger? Each one's world a stranger place than they had dreamed of, stranger than a foreign planet or a dream of danger. How strange now to be strangely loving you. As you to me, I am to you a stranger, yet two strangers met, and stranger than a landing on the moon, what could be stranger? Forgot that, now strange, dream of danger. Strange, you love me strangely, loving you. So that's my love poem to John.
What's next? What are you working on with John? You're working on his case, right?
I'm still working to help him, yes.
Mm-hmm. On that case. I'm talking with Joanna Catherine Scott, who, along with John Lee Conaway, has written a new collection of poems, An Innocent in the House of the Dead. Joanna, What a pleasure. Thank you for talking with us.
Thank you, Frank. And thank you guys at Central Prison for listening in. Good luck to you all. And be kind to each other. It'll make your life easier.
Joanna Catherine Scott's latest book is a volume of poetry, An Innocent in the House of the Dead. She reads at the West End Poetry Festival in Carrboro at 7:25 p.m. this Saturday, October 25th. For more information, you can go to joannacatherinescott.com. International songstress Angelique Kidjo joins us after a short break. Stay with us on The State of Things.